Good morning, and welcome to Talking About California. Here we continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, the state California, their home here, and their work. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. This morning, we have the great pleasure to talk with Professor Leanne Hinton. Leanne Hinton is Professor Emerita at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Department of Linguistics. Her work focuses on language revitalization, in particular of Native American languages. Professor Linton tells me she's a supporter of interdisciplinary approaches to linguistics and linguistic research. Maybe we can ask her about that. And research that relates to community needs and interests as well as to theory. She's active in teaching, research, and consulting. In 2006, she won the Lannan Foundation's Cultural Freedom Award. In 2012, she was awarded the Language, Linguistics, and the Public Award by the Linguistics Society of America. Her books include Bringing Our Languages Home, How to Keep Your Language Alive, The Green Book of Language Revitalization and Practice, and perhaps we'll get a chance to hear a bit about those. So good morning, Professor Linton.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm just fine, and if you don't mind, I'll call you Leanne.
That would be just fine.
Great. Well, listen, I have a fascinating biography in front of me sent to me. Thanks so much for sending it on. But let's hear it in your own words instead of having me read anymore. But first, Professor, well, Leanne, can you give us a little background? So I thought I'd ask you to tell us just a bit about what linguistics is. I wonder, probably most of our listeners only know it's what Noam Chomsky allegedly teaches. And then I wanted to ask you about your subject, California Native languages. So could we begin with a couple of quick answers there? What is linguistics?
Sure. Well, linguistics is a lot of different things, actually. All about language, of course. But there's linguistic theory, which is sort of about the form of language and what are the limitations on human language in terms of the structure of the language, the grammar, the syntax, the sound systems, and so on. That's not my field, though. I'm more interested in languages as a social phenomenon, and I specialize in American Indian languages primarily, but long ago I really stopped studying their form and what their grammar is like and just got into what they mean to people. And given that we've got a situation here where indigenous languages in the United States and really all over the world are declining, that is, that people are not speaking them anymore, I was interested in why that's the case and found that it's not their desire to have the languages go away and stop being spoken. And so I also became interested then in the issues of how you can reverse language shift, as it's often put, how people, communities can work to reclaim their languages.
Well, let's come back to that. But first of all, just a second quick thing. California Native languages, that's sort of the subject here. What can you tell us about them in general? I think some listeners may know, for instance, about the famous story of Ishi, the only one who spoke his language. Could you tell us a bit about California Native languages?
Yes. It's actually very fascinating because California is one of the most diverse places on Earth in terms of the sheer number of languages. So there were probably close to 100 different languages being spoken in California before contact with Europeans. Mm-hmm. And They were all different kinds of languages, too. They weren't languages that were dialects of each other or anything like that. They were just very different languages. For example, in Northern California, we have a lot of Athabascan languages that are spoken. And Athabascan is a language family that includes Navajo and languages all over Canada and Alaska. We also have languages in California that are related to the Algonquian languages of the Northeast, and we have other languages that are from families that exist nowhere except in California, such as Karuk and the which is also in the north, and then going down south we have the Yuman languages, the Chumash languages, the Yokuts languages, Maidu. And all of these are just different language families, and I haven't even by any means mentioned all of them.
So why, I mean, could you have, just in a word, why is this the case?
Well, part of it, I think, is just that, just like nowadays, everybody loves California. It's a very fine place to live. It's full of resources, and the resources are very varied. Right, so you can have, there's the ocean, full of rich resources. Then there's the mountains, and then there's the rich valleys in between, the rivers. There's all these different places that each have their own different kind of resources, and so there's a lot of room for a lot of different people. Because the resources are rich and the resources are varied. And so people can specialize in different things if they live in different places, and they can trade with each other. So I think the resources is one really important thing. And also it's been suggested that because of the obstacles to travel, which we don't think of very much anymore because of the highway system, but big rivers are hard to cross, and the mountains are hard, and there's islands that are hard to get to. And so people, when they live in certain places, they may live in this rather small area and not really leave very often. And so people don't spread out as much, and they can keep small boundaries because there's enough resources for them to survive.
So like Ishi, you might not know how to speak to your neighbor, so to speak.
Right. That would be the case in a lot of people, although there was a lot of bilingualism going on too. So people had the capability, not everybody in a community would have that capability, but there would be enough bilingual people to handle trade, and people would tend to sometimes marry out of their communities and become bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot more bilingual than people are today, I think.
Uh-huh. So how'd you get interested in this, Leanne? Maybe come back to your biography for our listeners a minute.
Yes. I could go way back to before I became interested in California. When I grew up in California, though, so I've always had some kind of interest in California languages and California life. But I started my fieldwork working with the Havasupai Indians in Arizona, and it was working with them that I became interested in language and community and how people who are doing linguistics can be working on projects that the community is interested in, too. And at the time that I was working with the Havasupais, they began being interested in getting a writing system for their language. And so a Havasupai committee and I worked together on that. And I also worked with the Wallapais, and together the two languages developed actually different writing systems. They wanted different writing systems to show the difference from each other, even though they're closely related. And I just found that the most interesting thing I'd ever done.
You were a student then?
Yes, I was a student. And I found it much more interesting than theoretical linguistics, where you're writing things for other people rather than, and for other linguists only, rather than doing things for other kinds of people as well. By the time I got my degree, bilingual education in the 1970s was going strong, and I started working with bilingual education with the Havasupais. So my first job was at University of Texas, but when I came here to California to join the faculty at Berkeley in 1978, I was already working on very practical projects with various groups. And so when I came to California, it was a pretty natural thing to start getting involved with Native American groups in California. But what really got me involved, I think, to begin with, was my friendship with Malcolm Margolin, who's the publisher at Heyday Books. And soon after I arrived, he began a journal called News from Native California. And it's a fabulous journal. If your listeners aren't aware of it, it would be great for them to take a look and maybe subscribe. And this journal, he asked me if I would write a language column. And so for years, I was writing a column for every quarterly issue about California languages. And it ended up as a book that you didn't mention, which is my my first book that has to do with California, and it's called Flutes of Fire, Essays on California Indian Languages. So in that process, I got to know a lot of people who were California Indians, and I started getting involved with a group called the Native California Network. And my first involvement with it was to be invited to a conference of California Indians, and that was in 1992, to talk about language issues, because it was clear that the languages were disappearing. There are already 30 to 40 languages that have no native speakers whatsoever. And the rest, at that time, most of them had fewer than 10, and now it's down to one or two speakers each that grew up speaking the language. So we had this meeting, and it was a wonderful meeting. People were talking about what could be done to help bring the languages back. People wanted new speakers, and how could that be done? And so a group of us formed a committee of the Native California Network called the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival. We'll call them the Advocates from now on.
Okay.
And the board consisted of, at that time, I believe, seven California Indians. And I've always just been an advisory board member of that group. But it's been, to me, one of the most central parts of my career ever since that committee was formed, which later on became its own nonprofit. So it still exists today, 20-some years later, as a very successful nonprofit who works with California Indians on projects that help with language reclamation. And we've formed a couple of programs that we run. One of them is called the Master Apprentice Language Learning Program, and the other one's called the Breath of Life Archival Workshop. So the Master Apprentice Program is for people who want to learn their language and they have access to a speaker. See, the problem is you can't go to a college course on your language in a situation like this. And you can't find a book that will teach you the language. So how do you learn the language? Well, you can learn the language by working with an elder who knows the language. And if you want, later on we can get into some details about how people can do this. So this has been one program that we've been running. People in California, probably about 35 different languages, have had at least one master apprentice team and probably more. Some of the groups have formed their own master apprentice programs so that they have multiple teams that they are training themselves. So this has been one program we've run, and another program we've run is the Breath of Life Archival Workshop for California Indians without speakers. Because the Berkeley campus has probably the best collection of California Indian language materials anywhere. That is that all of the linguists from California, anthropologists to begin with, starting from the very beginning of the university, all of the linguists and anthropologists that have worked on those languages, their field notes are in the archives at Berkeley. And so this workshop is for people who need to work with these materials, need to learn enough linguistics to understand what they're seeing in the way of written materials, learn enough to learn how the grammar works, or to be able to figure out how the grammar works, and then to take these materials and learn the language from them. So these are the programs that we've been running, and as you see, this has been perhaps even more important to me than my career at the university in terms of pleasure.
And just to repeat, you say we. Tell us again about who the we are.
Yes, the Advocates is a group that consists now of a board of, we have 9 members of the board, and they are California Indians from all over. And these programs I've been talking about, we developed them together. At least one of my books is specifically about one of those programs, the Master Apprentice program, the one that says How to Keep Your Language Alive, and that's co-authored by some of the members of the board. And they are all people who have been working with language most of their adult lives, who've learned their language as adults, or who have become language teachers themselves, who have developed that passion that where they want to keep their language alive, not just for themselves, but for other people as well. Most of them work on their language with their communities, but also as part of the Board of the Advocates, they help train other groups and work on these programs that I've talked about, as well as several other programs.
Now, is it just incidental that you're at the university, or is the university a sponsor of this work, or how is it?
The university is a partner in the Breath of Life workshop. So when we hold that every other year, and it's held right at the university, and people stay in the dorms, the Advocates has generally found most of the money that it takes to put people in the dorms and to give them their breakfast and lunch and so on. Then they host everybody, and the archivists at the university have been magnificent. They just devote this period of one full week to our group, and before that they devote an enormous amount of time to preparing for them, finding the right materials for the languages that will be studied, and finding the areas that they'll be working and so forth. So it's a partnership.
Okay.
But the rest of the work is done through private grants. We also have an administrator, Marina Drummer, who has done a great deal for in terms of being able to keep us financially solvent. I should say, by the way, that we have an increasing number of California Indians have themselves become linguists, and a couple of members of the board now are either already have degrees in linguistics. That would be Carly, who has an MA in linguistics, and we have a HOOPA board member who is a graduate student currently at Berkeley. So Berkeley, as a campus, has a lot of relationship, either directly or indirectly, with either our people or our programs.
Okay, this is KZYX. Our program is talking about California. You're listening today to Professor Leanne Hinton. She's talking about California native languages and her work with California peoples in terms of supporting the survival of native languages. I should say, by the way, Leanne, that later in this series we're going to be talking to Malcolm Margolin.
Oh, excellent.
And we'll talk a bit about the press that he works with, Heyday Press. Maybe you said you could tell listeners, though, a bit about that. Before we forget, why don't you... I think it's worth knowing about Heyday Press. Can you tell us how?
Yes. Well, Heyday Books is a press that focuses on California, and it has a number of pieces to it. It has the California Indian part of it, which is very strong, and in fact, Malcolm has just started a kind of a philosophy. He calls it the Berkeley Roundhouse, Roundhouse being a ceremonial structure in California Indian religion. And so California Indians is one big part of the press, but also California literature is another big part of the press. And California nature and ecology is another part of the press. And I met Malcolm just when he was starting up the press, because he had published a book or two of his own with another. I think he had published one book with a major press and didn't like how they did things. And so he self-published a second book and just started up this press. And when I first met him, it was out of his home. It was in his home was where the press was. And now he has a building on University Way with a large staff, but has somehow managed to keep a really wonderful philosophy about it all. He's a nonprofit press, and which used to mean he'd be broke, but things I think are looking up a bit, which is... A fine thing that you can say about publishers.
Okay, so that's Heyday Press in Berkeley.
Yes.
Okay.
And three of my books have been published by Heyday. And I've had books published by other presses, and other presses either let my books go out of print or sell them to another press, or they're too expensive, or they're not beautiful, so I've never been satisfied with any press except Heyday. They make absolutely beautiful books, and they never let my books go out of print.
Oh, quite a compliment. Let's get back to your books in a minute, but you're also a teacher and a scholar, Leanne, and looking at notes, it seems that you developed some of the very first courses involving native languages. Could you tell us just a bit about that process and what you teach and what mm-hmm. your students are doing in your classes?
Right. Well, as Professor Emeritus, I'm no longer teaching at Berkeley. Some of the courses that I developed are still taught there. And so, the first course I taught that was relevant was a course in American Indian languages. And that course was on the books long before I got there, because back when the department was first founded in 1952, I think it was, there was actually a kind of a rule, and that was that any graduate student had to write his dissertation on an American Indian language, preferably a California Indian language. And as Mary Haas, the founder of that philosophy, used to say, every language needs a dictionary, a grammar, and a body of text. And that would be every student's lifetime goal, was to make sure that that language that he was responsible for came out with a dictionary, a grammar, and a body of text. So now by the time I got there, American Indian languages was no longer the focus of the department, and I was the only one at the time that was working with American Indian languages. That's not true. Professor Wally Chafe was there, and later he went to Santa Barbara. And now we have several people working on American Indian languages. But at the time I came, there was kind of a lull in that, and people were working more with linguistic theory and general linguistics. And so I was in charge of teaching that course. Then the courses I developed, one of them was a course on endangered languages. So this is a graduate seminar that I developed in the early 90s. And again, there's quite a few courses around North America now on endangered languages. I should say many. But at that time, there was very little written on endangered languages, and especially on language revitalization, which was my interest. There was the beginnings of a big literature in the early 90s on language loss and the decline of linguistic diversity. But on language revitalization, there was nothing. And so I started this course, which was sort of half on to the decline of endangered languages, the decline of languages, and the decline of linguistic diversity, and then the other half was on language revitalization. And then another course I developed was a more general course. Berkeley has a program called the, it has a program of kind of American studies that it's called the American Cultures. And so there's a lot of courses in Berkeley that have been developed over the last 20 years on American cultures, which is a lot about the diversity of America. And so right at the beginning of that, I was asked to try to develop a course for the linguistics department. So it's a general course that generally has somewhere between 100 and 300 people taking it from all over campus. And it's called the American Languages. And it's about all the languages, about the about American Indian languages, about the languages that have been part of the United States since colonial times, and those would be languages such as French and German and Spanish, and the immigrant languages, and sort of what their status is, because many of these languages, that, besides American Indian languages, there's lots of varieties of European languages that are endemic to the United States, too, such as Cajun French and Louisiana French Creole, various varieties of Spanish that are endemic to the United States, Pennsylvania Dutch, and some of the other German varieties that are only in the United States. So we're really a very interesting multilingual nation, despite the feeling that we're just an English-speaking nation. So those are the main courses that I've developed.
So keeping on that subject a bit, you lecture and you give workshops, I see, pretty far afield, all over the world, in fact. So your interests go beyond, as you just said, just the California languages.
Right.
When you travel to different countries, what are you interested in looking for, and what do you tell people about?
Well, a large amount of my travel is really related to the programs that I told you about with the advocates. That and it's not just me that goes either, but some of the board members who are trainers will often go as well. So the Master Apprentice program especially has developed, people have developed an interest in it all over. So our manual, the How to Keep Your Language Alive book, it was some years back, it was translated into Portuguese to be used for the tribes of Brazil. And I went down there for the release of that version. And then in Canada, there's, and all over the United States, there's programs now that are the Master Apprentice style programs. So I'll go with other board members to give workshops, or I'll go be an evaluator of a program, or and so on. So that's all over Canada and the U.S. And more recently, Australia has gotten interested in it. And so last year, two board members and I traveled to Australia and gave two workshops for how people can train master apprentice teams. And this was attended by both linguists and by speakers and learners of various Aboriginal languages. So I think there were about 30 languages involved in those trainings. So I've visited the Samis in Finland, gave a talk there on language revitalization in the United States for a Sami conference.
Well, what's that? I don't recognize that.
Oh, sorry. The Samis. You might know them better as the Lapps.
Mm-hmm.
They're said to be the only indigenous group of Europe, although I don't know why Basque doesn't count as that, but I keep asking that. And they said, well, they're not culturally different enough. But so they're the reindeer herders of the north,
right?
Finland and Russia.
So before we leave the students, do the students do field work? Are they, is that part of their program? Are they traveling around too?
The students are, yes, the students now, even more since I retired, because there's some really great professors that are doing, doing the work there in the linguistics department nowadays. Students are working a lot now on California Indian languages, and they also are, as well as other languages in North America, and they also are doing a great deal of community service in those communities. So we have students now that are working on dictionaries with the community, and there's online dictionaries being developed so that the whole community can look at them. There's I have colleagues and students that led by people like led by Andrew Garrett, who go to the field and give workshops on the grammar of the specific languages that that they're working with, as well as doing their own dissertations on those languages. And we also have a faculty member, Lev Michael, who specializes in South American languages, and he has a field school every summer where, again, they're working both on dissertation work on those languages, the students are, and on projects that the community is involved with. So there's a lot going on from the department.
Okay, and one more question before we turn to some of the really, you know, nitty gritty of your project. How about this question? And don't worry about it too much. But just maybe is this being devil's advocate? Why is this important? Saving language? Well, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, well, of course, I get that question all the time, so I have some rehearsed answers.
Okay.
To me, though, and I can give some of those answers, but to me, the really important thing has to do with human rights. And when you look at why American Indian languages are disappearing, it's really a horrible story. There's been, I mean, forget the physical massacres that was going on in the first half of the 19th century and before, but that genocide was replaced eventually by what some people call a cultural genocide and linguistic genocide, in that these boarding schools were set up that were children were taken away from their families and put into these schools, which were usually in really bad situations, highly militaristic, not enough food. I mean, the stories go on and on, molestation and so on. And one of the policies of the school system, the policy of the government was you have to eradicate American Indian languages because that's the only way we'll ever get them to join civilization. You know, they were being trained. They weren't really even being educated. They were being trained to work in, to do labor, manual labor, and so on in people's homes and in towns and so forth. But they figured you can't keep your language and still be an American. And so they were being forced through physical punishment not to speak their languages at all, even if they were caught speaking it on the playground or in the dormitories, they'd be punished. And so this was really the beginning of the end of the languages. So people came out of there traumatized in enormous numbers of ways. It really disrupted the whole family structure that every human being should be a part of. And it also meant either that people forgot their languages, or that they were so traumatized by the punishment that they couldn't stand even trying to speak their language, or they internalized the feeling that their languages were inferior, and probably most of them made a decision not to pass their language on to their children. And, you know, so not everything that contributes to language loss is that horrible, but that horrible thing happened. And people feel like their languages were taken away from them. It's usually the second generation or the third generation that says, well, you know, I am an American, you know, I am able to hold down a job or I am able to do these things and I do speak English, but I want my language too and I want my culture too. And so this is a part of that movement, and I'm just pleased to be part of it.
Okay. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. Our program is talking about California. Our guest this morning is Professor Leanne Hinton, who's Professor Emerita at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Department of Linguistics. She's written many books, and we're talking this morning about some of her books and also about her practical work in the area of, I see one book, is How to Keep Your Language Alive. Maybe we should go there to sort of the nitty-gritty of what on earth do you do? And did you say that there are some languages where maybe only a handful of people speak them? What do you do in cases like that? But maybe you could give us a little bit of a seminar on the practicality of your work.
Yeah. I think I might preface it, though, by taking you out of California and looking at some of the highly successful language revitalization movements in the world. And one of them that's in the U.S. is the Hawaiian immersion school system. And they have, over the last 20 or 30 years, developed a whole new generation of speakers. So kids can go to school and learn their school subjects in the Hawaiian language. And English is, if anything, a foreign language, right? Except that they also speak English because their parents speak English, right? So they all know English. And it's Hawaiian then that's being taught not only as a language but as the subject of everything in the schools. And these kids come out as totally fluent speakers. And in fact, I'm going to be visiting one of those schools in a couple of weeks because we're working on looking at what happens when they leave school and what happens when they're not in school. Are they still using their language, and are they finding ways to use their language in their adult lives? So that's a really successful program. But it's successful partly because they were starting with a pretty good population base. And Hawaiian is the only indigenous language of that state. And so that means that the university can be very involved they have a wonderful second language Hawaiian program where people can learn Hawaiian extremely well while they're preparing to be teachers in the schools. And the state has made Hawaiian one of the two official languages, the other one being English. So it has a great deal of support. Now come to California, back to California. California, as I said, has maybe as many as 100 languages. And there's still at least 50 that have maybe one speaker at least, or two speakers, or five. It's been declining, of course, in the years that we've been doing this program in the last 20 years. Many, many of our native speakers have passed away. And that's the sad part of this program. But they have, at the same time, they've been working with young people to pass on as much of the language as they can. Now, these young people, how are they going to learn their language? They don't have a university where they can learn their language. There's maybe one or two people per language that want to learn to begin with, and who would teach the course in the university, and what kind of course would it be? It's pretty standard to teach the grammar of a language and how to write it and so forth for foreign language teaching, but do you learn to speak it? And that's really what people want. Their languages are spoken languages. Their languages don't even have, or didn't used to even have, writing systems. And those are, writing systems are things that tribes are developing now for their languages. There's no books on how to learn the language. So how, if you want to learn this language of your heritage, how are you going to go about doing it? So the program that we developed is a program for all these, it's for language diversity, right? It's for the diverse kind of situation that we have in California, where there's so many languages, and the tribes are very small. The number of people that can speak the language is very small, and the number of people that want to learn it at this point is very small. So we figure, well, you know, the best way to do it is probably to teach people how to learn their language from a speaker. And a lot of that is based on how do people learn their first language. Can we recreate that kind of situation where people are just hearing it all the time and hearing it in the course of their daily lives, where if it had been present all their life in the course of their daily lives, they would have learned it naturally. So that's one thing, is just trying to put them in a situation where they hear it a whole lot. And it's also not enough to just hear it if you have no idea what's being said. But the way kids learn their first language is that they're hearing it in a context where they understand what's being said. So somebody hands them a glass of milk and says, "You want some milk," right? Or they'll say, "Come give me a hug," and they open their arms for a hug. Right, so So the context is there that helps people understand what's being said. So what we do in our training is we show people how they can make themselves understood through context, through nonverbal communication of various sorts, like gestures and facial expressions and pointing to things and objects and actions and activities, that all of these things are the things that are communicating what's being said at the early stage of language learning. And this is not brand new to the Master Apprentice program. Programs such as TPR, Total Physical Response, and other kinds of immersion language teaching, that's where a lot of our ideas come from. So we're also training the apprentice in the Master Apprentice program, the learner, to be a very active learner, and to be perhaps a linguist in a way, to elicit language from the speaker. So when we have our trainings, the first thing we do is sort of an icebreaker, which is to convince people that you can make yourself understood, even if there's no common language between you. And we just give people cards, and each card says something like, get somebody to give you a dollar, or get somebody to sit on somebody else's lap, or something like that. And they're supposed to do that without using any language. Just you can do it in total silence, or if you want, you can use a language, but you can't ask somebody who knows your language to do it. And so they'll go around figuring out how to get somebody to do what's on their card. And it's an icebreaker. It makes people have fun, but it also teaches them that you can use this nonverbal way of communicating. And then the second exercise is always to have the learner and the teacher get together, and the learner has to learn how to ask some questions in the language. So he'll ask, what is this, or what is that, or what are you doing? Or if you're looking at a picture together, you could ask, what is he doing? What are they doing? We have a long list that we say this is their first job, is to master these questions. So that way they can, and then there can be also some tension-breaking questions, like, I forget, or if the teacher is asking them to say a word and they don't know it, they say, I forget, or say it again, or say it more slowly, or something like that, so that they can get the language that's being thrown at them. So this is just a couple of the beginning exercises of what we do for a training. But then after this training, which is about 2 days in length, they're pretty much on their own. And we have mentors that call them fairly regularly to see how things are going and to help them problem solve, because there can be, you know, they can get to a plateau where the learner feels like he's not learning anything anymore. There can be frustrations involved in trying to figure out what people are saying all the time. But that's sort of in a nutshell what we try to do, is we try to get them to learn how to do what we call immersion sets together, where maybe they'll plan it in English, but then they're going to work together in the language for 10 minutes or an hour or all day, depending on the thing. One of the things that we find really helpful in the very beginning is wordless books. I have a whole collection now of maybe 50 different books that have no words in them, where the story is told entirely in pictures. And at the very beginning, this is a great way for the master to feel comfortable staying in the language, because it's always hard for a speaker to stay in the language if your person you're speaking to doesn't understand. But the master can stay in the language. He can just tell the story and be pointing to things, and so the learner can understand in general, even if he doesn't understand any specific words, he can understand in general what the master is talking about. And the learner can also be asking questions in the language. Well, what is this? What is he doing? And get language that way. So for our training, that's a very comfortable first immersion exercise, and it's surprising how long people want to go, an hour, even if it's their very first time doing immersion together. And so we always send them home with a book or two also, one of the word list books.
Well, talking about books, though, so that our listeners can follow up perhaps on this, how about just give us a word or two about a couple of your books. You mentioned at the beginning of the talk, was it Flutes of Fire?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us about that, and then we'll go to one of your more recent publications.
Yeah. Well, Flutes of Fire it's a set of essays about California Indian languages, and it's based on the column that I used to run in News from Native California. And it starts out with a look at how many languages there are and how many speakers there are. And then it goes through a set of essays that talk a little bit about how interesting California Indian languages are. You know, some of the aspects of various languages. So, for example, I talk about directionals in Karuk, which is that when you're saying when you have a verb, you pretty much have to talk about direction of the verb. So, like if you say he's walking, you actually have an affix, a part of the verb that means uphill or downhill or upstream or downstream. Or if he's throwing something, you have to say which direction he's throwing it in. Is it uphill or downhill or upstream or downstream or across the hill or along the bank? I mean, there's just probably 40 or 50 different directional affixes that go on these verbs. Interestingly, they do not have words for north, south, east, or west. And many California Indians languages do, but they have the concepts that are shown in various ways, but they don't have those particular words, partly because people didn't travel north, south, east, or west. They traveled primarily by boat, and so upstream and downstream along their river was the most important directions, and of course that goes in different directions all the time, so no use to say I'm going north because part of the time you're going west or east or whatever as the river curves. So that would be one thing. Another thing would be kinship terms and how kinship is dealt with in different languages, different California Indian languages, and how it differs from English. And so I probably have 8 or 10 chapters just on some of the really interesting things about California Indian languages. And you know how there's this sort of a myth, I guess, that Eskimos have lots of different words for snow. Well, California Indians have lots of different words for baskets and lots of different words for basketry designs and enormous wealth of vocabulary around basket making. So I have another chapter on that. And then later, the book starts talking about language loss and language decline, a little bit about quoting some people. There was a chapter actually by Vera Mae Fredrickson in there on people who'd been to boarding school and talking about their boarding school experiences and how it affected their decisions about their language. And then there's some talk about some of the linguists, early linguists that have studied the languages, like J.P. Harrington, who was an amazing character who had this passion for languages, especially California Indian languages. And he he was a very passionate man, and he saw the languages disappearing. And he used to write letters to his people who were his assistants. He'd send them out into the field, and he'd say, the house is burning. The languages are going to be dead. You have to get this this one person who's the last speaker of this language before he dies. And people find him in one incident was finding a man who was the last speaker in a hospital, and the assistant wrote to Harrington saying, "Oh, but he's in the hospital and he's on his deathbed." And Harrington would be saying, "Can't they give him a pill to pep him up?" things like that.
So that's Flutes of Fire, right?
And then I just have to end with Language just, Revitalization. And
right, but just fire. That is that still available?
Yes, it is.
And that's Heyday?
That's Heyday Books.
Okay.
I'll be writing a second edition of it in the next couple of years.
Right. Well, let's now get to your last project.
So the most recent book is Bringing Our Languages Home, Language Revitalization for Families. And that goes beyond California. It has a couple of chapters on California, but also chapters on other languages around the world. And mostly, this is it's a book I edited. Mostly the heart of the book is actually autobiographical stories that are written by people that use their languages at home. And so, for example, there's a California chapter where Ellie and Phil Albers, who are Karuk language learners, who both went through master apprentice approaches to learn their languages, are now raising their children in the Karuk language. And there's this great moment when Ellie found out she was pregnant, and it was an accident. So she was with their first child, and she looked over at Phil with dread, and Phil looked back at her, and he said, "We only have 9 months to learn our language." And she would be playing tapes to the womb while she was pregnant, and everything. It's a wonderful story about language learning. So, and then there's also chapters on Walbiri, a family, actually a linguist, an American linguist who used an Australian Aboriginal language at home with his children because there were so few speakers left and it was dying, and he wanted to make sure that it lived for another generation. And there's stories about Gaelic and various other American Indian languages, including Miami and Wampanoag. Those are two languages that the heroes of the stories learned through documentation entirely because there were no speakers, and now are using those languages at home with their children. It's actually, I find those stories very moving and very powerful, and they really say a lot as to why it's worth doing.
So that book is Bringing Our Languages Home, Language Revitalization for Families, and that's Heyday as well, is that right?
Yes, it is.
And that's just published.
That's right.
Okay. How about, and we've got a minute left here, Leanne, let me ask you what about, can you imagine a truly multilingual California, and would that be a good thing?
Well, I think it would be a good thing. I think that people just don't pay enough attention to the notion of bilingualism. Human beings are very capable of being bilingual. And it's a good thing in the United States to know English. There's no doubt about it. But do you have to give up your heritage language and your heritage culture? Can that not be part of America, too? This is something that is a big debate in the United States right now. And there's many of the more conservative brand of language watchers that like the English only movement that just don't want things like other languages to hold sway in the United States. I think the English has even been imbued a lot as with the notion of patriotism, that you can't be an American if you are being, if your loyalties are divided, as President Teddy Roosevelt once said in the early 20th century, that there is only room for one language in America, and that is English. Well, I don't believe that. I think there's room for lots of languages in America. And there's no doubt that English is the common language and will stay the common language, but there's no reason why other people can't keep a language that's also meaningful to them.
Well, thanks very much, Leanne. Really appreciate you
coming on the program.
It. Oh, that's great. And this is Talking About California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. This morning we've been talking to Professor Leanne Hinton from the University of California in Berkeley, the Department of Linguistics, talking about lots of things, but Native American languages in particular. So we'll be back next week at this time. Thanks for listening, and good morning.